Paperclip capitalist, a satanic stage double? The German scientists were of no real importance without the bankers that exploited them wherever they went. A shadow administration of paperclip capitalists invested in booming space technology, mostly for military objectives. They were executives of multinational corporations, enterprise-level contractors, and global business financiers. Operation Paperclip zigzagged through subversive Odessa terrains to good neighbor Ratlins, and from the fringes turned up in a garden patch of sham DARPA Disneyland. Had a counterfeit black ops con Disney playing field cropped up alongside the real one, in mutual tolerance of each other's ideologies? Did the CIA military-industrial complex permeate and direct a fraudulent Disney stage in order to manipulate the Motion Picture Guild? Did MK-Ultra mass brainwashing procedures make use of calculated hypnotic suggestions in Hollywood films to prop up Nazi space technology and to entrust U.S. ballistic missile authority? It put the finishing touches to the Hollywood Tinker Bell moment, a fleeting lapse of logic that lets fantasy overpower the mind and glorifies the false piety of peer pressure. It appealed to mainstream conservative attitudes with German scientists warmly unveiling spacecraft in televised fireside chats. It tempted avant-garde liberal awareness with erotic metaphors and daydream phallic symbols subliminally hidden in cartoons. Contradictory messages smashed together like express locomotives in children's subconscious minds to engender a nationwide shortage of self-confidence. Did the CIA military-industrial mob gradually take the place of an American parent figure perched in a TV box? Not to anyone's doubt, senior executives and board directors of the counterfeit Disney operation in Argentina flaunted the self-indulgence of Washington lobbyists. Even Walt Disney could be replaced with a privileged look-alike. When it comes to the duping of moral principles, do what thou wilt, Walt shall be the whole of the law. In Trading with the Enemy, 1983, reporter Charles Higham presented proof why Operation Paperclip was so rewarding. Higham came across guilt-ridden information in the National Archives diplomatic records room while declassifying documents in the course of writing a biography that dealt with motion picture star Errol Flynn's Nazi associations. It would be comforting to believe that the financial establishment of the United States and the leaders of American industry were united in a common purpose following the Day of Infamy, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Certainly, the American public was assured that big business, along with all of the officials of government, ceased from the moment the war began to have any dealings whatsoever with the enemy. That assurance sustained the morale of millions of Americans who bore arms in World War II and their kinfolk who stayed at home and suffered the anguish of separation. But the heartbreaking truth is that a number of financial and industrial figures of World War II and several members of the government served the cause of money before the cause of patriotism. While aiding the United States war effort, they also aided Nazi Germany's. Charles Higham, Trading with the Enemy, An Exposé of the Nazi-American Money Plot 1933-1949, 1983. The American car manufacturer Henry Ford was probably the most famous of Nazi Germany's foreign backers. In 1912 he introduced the assembly line method to manufacture his Model T cars. The Nazis copied assembly line procedures to incarcerate and murder millions of prisoners. For his ongoing support, Ford was rewarded in the 1930s with the highest Nazi decoration for foreigners. On December 20, 1922, the New York Times reported that automobile manufacturer Henry Ford was financing Adolf Hitler's nationalist and anti-Semitic movements in Munich. Simultaneously, the Berlin newspaper Berliner Tageblatt appealed to the American ambassador in Berlin to investigate and halt Henry Ford's intervention into German domestic affairs. It was reported that Hitler's foreign backers had furnished a spacious headquarters with a host of highly paid lieutenants and officials. Henry Ford's portrait was prominently displayed on the walls of Hitler's personal office. Henry Ford's funds were used to provoke the Bavarian Rebellion, Munich Beer Hall Putsch. The rebellion failed, and Hitler was arrested and brought to trial. In February 1923 at the trial, Vice President Auer of the Bavarian Diet testified. The Bavarian Diet has long had the information that the Hitler movement was partly financed by an American anti-Semitic chief, who is Henry Ford. Mr. Ford's interest in the Bavarian anti-Semitic movement began a year ago when one of Mr. Ford's agents, seeking to sell tractors, came in contact with Diedrich Eichardt, the notorious Pan-German. Shortly after, Herr Eichardt asked Mr. Ford's agent for financial aid. The agent returned to America and immediately Mr. Ford's money began coming to Munich. Herr Hitler openly boasts of Mr. Ford's support and praises Mr. Ford as a great individualist and a great anti-Semite. A photograph of Mr. Ford hangs in Herr Hitler's quarters, which is the center of monarchist movement. Anthony C. Sutton, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, 1976. Author Anthony C. Sutton wrote in his book Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, that Henry Ford was something of a disappointment. Understanding his influence on Western civilization is difficult and sometimes bizarre and dismal. In 1928 Henry Ford merged his assets with IG Farben, the German chemical cartel, which bolstered the Nazi cause. During the 1960s, military transport vehicles sent to Vietnam to support the Viet Cong were from a plant that Ford had built in the Soviet Union. As said by the Corporate Watch Group, due to their multinational control of motor vehicle production, GM and Ford became principal suppliers for the forces of fascism as well as for the forces of democracy. The following is from a report by the United States Senate Committee on the Judiciary in 1974. The activities of General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler prior to and during World War II are instructive. At that time, these three firms dominated motor vehicle production in both the United States and Germany. Due to its mass production capabilities, automobile manufacturing is one of the most crucial industries with respect to national defense. As a result, these firms retain the economic and political power to affect the shape of governmental relations both within and between these nations in a manner which maximized corporate global profits. In short, they were private governments unaccountable to the citizens of any country yet possessing tremendous influence over the course of war and peace in the world. The substantial contribution of these firms to the American war effort in terms of tanks, aircraft components, and other military equipment is widely acknowledged. Less well known are the simultaneous contributions of their foreign subsidiaries to the Axis powers. In sum, they maximized profits by supplying both sides with the materiel needed to conduct the war. The outbreak of war in September 1939 resulted inevitably in the full conversion by GM and Ford of their Axis plants to the production of military aircraft and trucks. On the ground, GM and Ford subsidiaries built nearly 90% of the armored mule 3-ton half-trucks and more than 70% of the Reich's medium and heavy-duty trucks. These vehicles, according to American intelligence reports, served as the backbone of the German army transportation system. After the cessation of hostilities, GM and Ford demanded reparations from the U.S. government for wartime damages sustained by their Axis facilities as a result of Allied bombing. Bradford C. Snell, Committee of the Judiciary, Subcommittee on Antitrust and Monopoly, United States Senate, February 26, 1974. By 1998, major American car companies were embroiled in a debate similar to Swiss banks that became the target of a worldwide uproar over their business dealings with Germany. After the outbreak of war in September 1939, General Motors and Ford became crucial to the Nazi military. Both General Motors and Ford insist that they bear little or no responsibility for the operations of their German subsidiaries, which controlled 70% of the German car market at the outbreak of war in 1939 and rapidly retooled themselves to become suppliers of war materiel to the German army. But documents discovered in German and American archives show a much more complicated picture. In certain instances, American managers of both GM and Ford went along with the conversion of their German plants to military production at a time when U.S. government documents show they were still resisting calls by the Roosevelt administration to step up military production in their plants at home. Michael Dobbs, Ford, and GM scrutinized for alleged Nazi collaboration, Washington Post, November 30, 1998. In his report Ford and the Führer, January 24, 2000, Ken Silverstein, a Washington, D.C.-based writer, said he found a poem titled Führer among thousands of pages of documents compiled by a Washington law firm which sought damages from Ford on behalf of a Russian woman who toiled as a slave laborer at its German plant. The poem ran in an in-house magazine published by Ford Motor Company's German subsidiary in April of 1940. We have sworn to you once. But now we make our allegiance permanent. Like currents in a torrent lost. We all flow into you. Even when we cannot understand you. We will go with you. One day we may comprehend. How you can see our future. Hearts like bronze shields. We have placed around you. And it seems to us, that only. You can reveal God's world to us. On the face of it, the paperclip bankers who made colossal revenues by producing war stockpiles for the Reich regarded the Führer as the occult seer of a personality cult. They outwardly deified him as a neo-pagan god, i.e., the firstborn of the Illuminati. Researcher Robert Mulcahy and several other historians laid blame on Henry Ford for sponsoring the publication of articles in the Dearborn Independent newspaper for several years, and for being the publisher of several books that attacked and demonized Jews, spreading hatred throughout the American Midwest. Henry Ford strongly opposed the organization of labor unions at his plants, only taking a softer line in the 1940s. It was around this time that a book, titled The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, was brought to Ford's attention by Boris Braisal, a Russian émigré. The book contained the supposed minutes of a secret Zionist meeting in Switzerland, where Jews had plotted to take control of the world, with the goal of enslaving all non-Jews, and it warned of an upcoming final battle between Jews and Anglo-Saxons. The book turned out to be a forgery made by the Russian secret police, but that did not alter the effect it had on people already suspicious of Jews and other immigrants. The Dearborn Independence articles began to take on a more paranoid tone, regulating the Jews to being the scapegoats of America's woes, especially responsible for the rising unemployment rate and faltering economy. Robert Mulcahy, Henry Ford and His Anti-Semitism, Traces.org. On May 22, 1922, the first of 91 successive articles on the international Jew, the world's problem, was published in the Dearborn Independent. The alarming articles were written to sway bankers, lawyers, advertising agencies, and office professionals. In another instance of trading with the enemy, U.S. computer giant IBM allegedly helped perpetrate one of history's most vile misdeeds. A lawsuit filed in 2001 alleged that IBM took part in crimes against humanity by allowing its machines to be used in Nazi death camps. A 2001 book on the subject, by Washington-based researcher Edwin Black, was titled IBM and the Holocaust. It claimed that punch card machines built by IBM were a key factor enabling the Nazis to make their killing operations more efficient. The German subsidiary Dehomag, Deutsche Hallerath-Maschinen-Gesellschaft, used the punch card technology under license. The ITS Holocaust files have over 50 million reference cards. The lawsuit claimed IBM, International Business Machines, provided technology, products, and services it knew would be used to assist persecution and genocide. A machine made by IBM was used in the 1933 German census, the year the Nazis took power, and is on display at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. IBM Germany was accused of forcing people to work as slaves for the Nazis during the war. In an AP archive photo, Thomas J. Watson, head of IBM, presented himself to Adolf Hitler in Berlin in 1937. A book review by Peter Reid for the World Socialist website said that Edwin Black's research into the involvement of IBM helps in understanding how the Nazis were able to carry through their genocide, and sheds more light on the role of international capital in one of the greatest crimes of the 20th century. Right from the start, IBM developed business solutions for the Third Reich. In April 1933, the Hitler regime began a census of all Germans, partly aimed at identifying Jews. The first step was to register data about the citizens of Germany's largest state, Prussia, which Dehomag was commissioned to undertake. The procedure that was established in this census gives an example of how the cooperation between Dehomag and the Nazis would work in practice in the fields of statistical and data collection. To cater to the specific requirements of Germany's statistical programs, the closest collaboration between Dehomex technicians and the Nazi authorities was necessary. Every project required specific customized applications. First, Dehomex was specifically informed about the task to be undertaken. Then mock UPS of punch cards were produced with pen and pencil marking the columns and holes to carry the needed information. Production of the punch cards only began if both Dehomex and the German reporting agencies were happy with the result. The company then manufactured and sold the cards, often pre-printed with project names. Once a project was undertaken, the company trained the personnel to carry out the work. With the expansion of its enterprise, Dehomex needed constant technical innovations and developments. Far from intervening in its German subsidiary to halt its collaboration with the Nazi persecution, IBM in New York carefully supervised the whole process and also would make sure that all technical requirements were provided. Dehomex technicians were constantly sent to the US for training. Peter Raid, How IBM Helped the Nazis, WSWS.org, June 27, 2001. IBM founder Thomas Watson purportedly cooperated with the Nazis for the sake of profit. CNetNews.com's Paul Festa debated the IBM issues in a 2001 discussion. In Analysis of Facts, author Edwin Black outspokenly stated, "We're not just talking about the German subsidiary. We're talking about the Swiss, the Swedish, the Italian, the Spanish, the Polish, the Romanian, and Brazilian subsidiaries, more than 20 subsidiaries located across Europe and elsewhere." This was, in fact, a global commitment by IBM to support the Hitler machine as it conquered Europe and as it destroyed ethnic peoples, Gypsies, Jews, and others. IBM would want to say they lost control of their German subsidiaries. That's clearly false. Thomas Watson and the New York office micromanaged every aspect of their subsidiaries in Europe and especially in Germany, their most profitable foreign operation. The New York office was aware of all uses for their machines in Germany and Nazi-occupied Europe from the moment Hitler came to power in 1933 until about the fall of 1941, 2 years after World War II started. Remember, IBM custom designed the machines, custom designed the applications and custom printed the punch cards. There were no universal punch cards or machine wiring. Programs to identify Jews, Jewish bank accounts, barrels of oil, Luftwaffe flights, welfare payments, train schedules into camps, and even the concentration camp information, all these had to be tailored for each application. Paul Festa, Probing IBM's Nazi Connection, CNetNews.com, June 28, 2001. According to a 2004 BBC News report, the IBM case was one of many lawsuits launched by groups representing Jewish, Gypsy and other victims of the Holocaust. Most actions so far have been based in the US, and have targeted German companies such as Daimler Chrysler, Volkswagen, and Siemens, which can be shown to have profited from Nazi-era slave labor. Eric Orchard of Reuters talked about the IBM issue with former infantry officer Robert Wolf, who worked as part of Edwin Black's research team. Wolf told Reuters historians were finding new meaning in previously available papers documenting the use of IBM Hall-Erith computer machines to carry out the Holocaust. "For those who have complained the proof is not there, this leaves little room for deniability," said Wolf, who assisted on research for Black's book. He said data found in newly uncovered German documents, when combined with IBM corporate files and eyewitness accounts and other sources, answer criticisms first leveled at Black's claims. "This is the proof that IBM enabled the Holocaust. The connection to New York is now proven," Wolf, a former U.S. infantry officer who ran denazification programs during the U.S. occupation of post-war Germany, said in a phone interview. Francie Grace, IBM, and Nazi Germany, CBS News, February 11, 2009. The IBM lawsuit was dropped in April 2001. Lawyers said they feared proceeding with the suit would slow down payments from a special German Holocaust fund created to compensate forced laborers and others who had suffered due to the Nazi persecution. Critics, however, claimed the lawsuit was dropped because further investigations would have revealed that IBM produced the CPU of the Berlin War Machine. There is ample speculation that technology provided by IBM may have allowed the Germans to gain an early advantage over the Allies in ballistic missile design and atomic fission research, in order to advance Nazi development of the first rocket-age weapons. John D. Rockefeller, the world's traditional billionaire, was probably America's most cunning investor. Descended from German immigrants, he became a fascist financier and Nazi partner. The Rockefeller Foundation is the primary public relations backer for the United Nations Radical Depopulation Program. Rockefeller's classic rags-to-riches success story eclipsed his part in a failed fascist plot by corporate leaders to overthrow President F.D. Roosevelt. According to the life history published by Press for Conversion magazine editor Richard Sanders, John D. Rockefeller's father, William Avery Rockefeller, was a traveling, snake oil salesman. Big Bill excelled as a quack doctor, or pitchman, conning the sick and desperate into buying expensive remedies that were either useless or downright dangerous. He would be gone for months and come back with a great roll of money. He would go to small towns and put up handbills advertising himself as the celebrated Dr. Livingston. He advertised to cure anything, but made a specialty of cancer and kidney troubles. McDonald, Double Life, New York World, February 2, 1908. Richard Sanders spelled out Big Bill's identity fraud in plain words. He was indicted for rape, but was not arrested or tried. He fled the area with family and escaped neighbors who accused him of horse thieving, burglary, arson and counterfeiting. He had two wives, simultaneously, and was a bigamist for 34 years. He met his second wife in Norwich, Ontario, where he sold lumber in 1853, calling himself William Livingston. I was born in the wagon of a traveling show. My mama used to dance for the money they'd throw. Papa would do whatever he could. Preach a little gospel, sell a couple bottles of Dr. Good. Gypsies, tramps and thieves. We'd hear it from the people of the town. They'd call us, gypsies, tramps and thieves. But every night all the men would come around. And lay their money down. Cher, Gypsies, Tramps and Thieves, 1971. Oil monopolist John D. Rockefeller created the family-run Rockefeller Foundation in 1909. By 1929 he had placed $300 million worth of the family's controlling interest in the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, now called Exxon, to the account of the foundation. The foundation's money created the medical specialty known as psychiatric genetics. For the new experimental field, the foundation reorganized medical teaching in Germany, creating and thenceforth continuously directing the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Psychiatry and the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology, Eugenics and Human Heredity. The Rockefellers' chief executive of these institutions was the fascist Swiss psychiatrist Ernst Rudin, assisted by his protégés Edmar Vertuer and Franz J. Kallmann. Anton Chaitkin, Population Control, Nazis and the U.N., Tetrahedron, LLC Press, 2002. In 1932, the British-led eugenics movement designated the Rockefellers' Dr. Rudin as the president of the Worldwide Eugenics Federation. The movement called for the killing or sterilization of people whose heredity made them a public burden. In 1911, John Foster Dulles summed up eugenics, saying that by eliminating the weakest members of the population, a purer race could be created. In his book, The Rockefeller File, Gary Allen wrote, "The alliance between Nazi Germany and the Rockefellers is truly shocking." He explained, "Hitler's Luftwaffe ran on Standard Petrol, and the Rockefellers were partners in IG Farben Industries, whose thousands of war products included the poison gas used in Nazi death camps." Max Warburg, stated author Jim Mars, a major German banker, and his brother Paul Warburg, who had been instrumental in establishing the Federal Reserve System in the United States, were directors of Interessengemeinschaft Farben or IG Farben, the giant German chemical firm that produced Zyklon B gas used in Nazi extermination camps. The Nazi Connection, then EU Alexandria Library.com, October 17, 2003. IG Farben became the largest chemical company in the world through a merger of companies such as BASF, Bayer, Agfa, and others. This combine opened the Auschwitz prison camp on June 14, 1940 to produce artificial rubber and gasoline from coal using proprietary patents rights granted by Standard. Standard Oil and IG Farben provided the capital and technology while Hitler supplied the labor consisting of political enemies and Jews. Standard withheld these patents from U.S. military and industry but supplied them freely to the Nazis. Under the Nazis, the German chemical company IG Farben and Rockefeller's Standard Oil of New Jersey were effectively a single firm, merged in hundreds of cartel arrangements. IG Farben was led, up until 1937, by the Warburg family, Rockefeller's partner in banking and in the design of Nazi German eugenics. Following the German invasion of Poland in 1939, Standard Oil pledged to keep the merger with IG Farben going even if the U.S. entered the war. This was exposed in 1942 by Senator Harry Truman's investigating committee, and President Roosevelt took hundreds of legal measures during the war to stop the Standard IG Farben cartel from supplying the enemy war machine. In 1940-41, IG Farben built a gigantic factory at Auschwitz in Poland, to utilize the Standard Oil/IG Farben patents with concentration camp slave labor to make gasoline from coal. The SS was assigned to guard the Jewish and other inmates and select for killing those who were unfit for IG Farben slave labor. Standard Germany President Emil Helfferich testified after the war that Standard Oil funds helped pay for SS guards at Auschwitz. Anton Chaitkin, Population Control, Nazis, and the U.N., Tetrahedron, LLC Press, 2002. Evidence presented to Washington committees after World War II confirmed that Standard Oil had seriously imperiled the war preparations of the United States. When Hitler took over Germany, the Rockefeller apparatus became a section of the Nazi state. Regrettably, the congressional committees did not explore an even more ominous aspect of the Standard Oil IG Farben collusion, that at this time directors of Standard Oil of New Jersey had not only strategic warfare affiliations to IG Farben, but had other links with Hitler's Germany even to the extent of contributing, through German subsidiary companies, to Heinrich Himmler's personal fund and with membership in Himmler's circle of friends as late as 1944. During World War II, Standard Oil of New Jersey was accused of treason for this pre-war alliance with Farben, even while its continuing wartime activities within Himmler's circle of friends were unknown. Anthony C. Sutton, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, 1976. The Worldwide Eugenics Federation organization called for the murder or sterilization of people whose genetics made them a social liability. With this corrupt scientific statement of belief, the Nazis conspired to exterminate the destitute masses of Europe. In 1943, Edmar Verschwer's assistant Joseph Menschel was made medical commandant of Auschwitz. As wartime director of Rockefeller's Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology, Eugenics and Human Heredity in Berlin, Verschwer secured funds for the Menschel's experiments at Auschwitz from the German Research Council. Verschwer wrote a progress report to the council. My co-researcher in this research is my assistant, the anthropologist and physician Menschel. He is serving as Hauptsturmführer and camp doctor in the concentration camp Auschwitz. With the permission of the Reichsführer SS Himmler, anthropological research is being undertaken on the various racial groups in the concentration camps and blood samples will be sent to my laboratory for investigation. Menschel prowled the railroad lines leading into Auschwitz, looking for twins, a favorite subject of psychiatric geneticists. On arrival at Menschel's experimental station, twins filled out a detailed questionnaire from the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. There were daily drawings of blood for Verschwer's specific protein research. Needles were injected into eyes for work on eye color. There were experimental blood transfusions and infections. Organs and limbs were removed, sometimes without anesthetics. Sex changes were attempted. Females were sterilized, males were castrated. Thousands were murdered and their organs, eyeballs, heads, and limbs were sent to Verschwer and the Rockefeller Group at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. Anton Chaitkin, Population Control, Nazis, and the U.N., Tetrahedron, LLC Press, 2002. Rockefeller was also funding fascism of the left. By providing monetary assistance, with bureaucratic restrictions, to some communist agents, a growing trust in collective equality and the fair distribution of global wealth could be discredited as a demonic plot. According to Jim Mars, in his book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, Leon Trotsky was living in America in 1917. Trotsky lived in New Jersey on Standard Oil property. 1917 was an interesting year, it was the year of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Standard Oil was owned by what powerful American family? The Rockefellers. Once again, they are connected with a self-serving project, and financing a foreign war. After his expulsion from Russia by the Tsar in order to prevent revolution, Trotsky went to France, and from there he was invited to come live in America. Standard Oil was promised a better share of the oil profits in Russia than the Tsar would offer, if the Bolsheviks were to win. Trotsky was called back to Russia by Lenin, but was detained in Nova Scotia by the Canadians. Trotsky was freed and set back on his journey by a passport signed by Woodrow Wilson and paid for by the Rockefellers. This also agrees with the claim of Daniel Estulin in his book The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. Jeremy Slate, Standard Oil, NWO, Nazi Benefits, and the Rockefeller Family, The Politics of Conscience, July 11, 2012. In renouncing the political beliefs of social equality, proud dogmas of racial supremacy secretly defended a Germanic bloodline monarchist movement. Religious traditions would be swept away by secular demands. The Bilderberg Group, as reported by Jim Mars, would before long emerge as the new corporate gang and global elite. In his eerie perspective, the Fourth Reich is a metaphor for the Fourth Rockefeller generation. In 1934, U.S. Major General Smedley Butler, America's most decorated soldier, was reportedly asked by elite corporate leaders to participate in the overthrow of President Roosevelt and to dictate the fascist takeover of the United States with 500,000 troops. Patriot Smedley Butler steadfastly rejected the proposal and exposed the treasonous plan. In recent times, reporter Tony Bond wrote that the Nazis received intelligence to give the appearance that the Germans were superior fighters by Wall Streeters such as Prescott Bush, whose Union Banking Corporation was seized by the government under the Trading with the Enemy Act. Our belief is that they were not so gifted, owing their advantages to Wall Street traders who supplied a stream of tactical and strategic intelligence to delay their defeat. Many studies produced after the war and down into 1980s gave Germans numerically higher combat effectiveness scores due to superior fighting doctrine, but we now believe that much of this advantage can be traced to treacherously provided war intelligence. Tony Bond, The Treason of Standard Oil, Exxon, During World War II, The American Chronicle, February 4, 2012. Rumors stirred by stories in The New Yorker and other publications spread unpleasant allegations that George W. Bush's grandfather and great-grandfather worked for Brown Brothers Harriman, and had clients who funded the building of the Nazi regime. The internet currently hosts hundreds of sites giving volumes of details and listing sources like The New York Times and the Library of Congress. The central charge against Prescott Bush has a basis in fact. In 1942, under the Trading with the Enemy Act, the U.S. government seized several companies in which he had an interest. Prescott at the time was an investment banker with Brown Brothers Harriman, BBH, which had funneled U.S. capital into Germany during the 1920s and 30s. Among the seized companies was the Union Banking Corporation, UBC, of New York, which was controlled by German industrialist Fritz Thyssen. Thyssen had been an early financier of the Nazi Party. In fact, in 1941 he published a book entitled I Paid Hitler. Ergo, Prescott helped finance the Nazis. Cecil Adams, was President Bush's great-grandfather a Nazi? The Straight Dope, February 14, 2003. Attorney John Loftus, a former federal prosecutor and past president of the Florida Holocaust Museum in St. Petersburg, co-authored a book in 1994 with Mark Aarons titled The Secret War Against the Jews, How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. The book alleges various misdeeds by George W.'s father, George H.W., his grandfather, Prescott Bush, and his great-grandfather, George Herbert Walker. According to Loftus, multi-billionaire steel magnate Fritz Thyssen, the author of I Paid Hitler, was also the man whose steel combine was the cold heart of the Nazi war machine. Thyssen did not need any foreign bank accounts because his family secretly owned an entire chain of banks. He did not have to transfer his Nazi assets at the end of World War II, all he had to do was transfer the ownership documents, stocks, bonds, deeds and trusts from his bank in Berlin through his bank in Holland to his American friends in New York City, Prescott Bush and Herbert Walker. Thyssen's partners in crime were the father and father-in-law of a future president of the United States. Attorney John Loftus, How the Bush Family Made Its Fortune from the Nazis, Tetrahedron Publishing Group, September 27, 2000. The Guardian newspaper reported in 2004 that it had obtained confirmation from newly discovered files in the U.S. National Archives that a firm of which Prescott Bush was a director was involved with the financial architects of Nazism. The debate over Prescott Bush's behavior has been bubbling under the surface for some time. There has been a steady internet chatter about the Bush/Nazi connection, much of it inaccurate and unfair. But the new documents, many of which were only declassified last year 2003, show that even after America had entered the war and when there was already significant information about the Nazis' plans and policies, he worked for and profited from companies closely involved with the very German businesses that financed Hitler's rise to power. It has also been suggested that the money he made from these dealings helped to establish the Bush family fortune and set up its political dynasty. Three sets of archives spell out Prescott Bush's involvement. All three are readily available, thanks to the efficient U.S. archive system and a helpful and dedicated staff at both the Library of Congress in Washington and the National Archives at the University of Maryland. The first set of files, the Harriman Papers in the Library of Congress, show that Prescott Bush was a director and shareholder of a number of companies involved with Thyssen. The second set of papers, which are in the National Archives, are contained in Vesting Order No. 248, which records the seizure of the company assets. What these files show is that on October 20, 1942, the alien property custodian seized the assets of the UBC, of which Prescott Bush was a director. Having gone through the books of the bank, further seizures were made against two affiliates, the Holland American Trading Corporation and the Seamless Steel Equipment Corporation. By November, the Silesian American Company, another of Prescott Bush's ventures, had also been seized. The third set of documents, also at the National Archives, are contained in the files on I.G. Farben, who was prosecuted for war crimes. How Bush's Grandfather Helped Hitler's Rise to Power, The Guardian, September 24, 2004. Three subsequent generations of the Bush family have been Yale alumni. Prescott Bush was admitted to the Skull and Bone Secret Society. George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush were also members of that society. The Guardian newspaper sought to make public any links between Prescott Bush, Thyssen, Consolidated Silesian Steel Company, CSSC, and Auschwitz crimes. Thyssen's partner in United Steel Works, which had coal mines and steel plants across the region, was Friedrich Flick, another steel magnate who also owned part of IG Farben, the powerful German chemical company. Flick's plants in Poland made heavy use of slave labor from the concentration camps in Poland. According to a New York Times article published in March 18, 1934, Flick owned two-thirds of CSSC while American interests held the rest. The U.S. National Archive documents show that BBH's involvement with CSSC was more than simply holding the shares in the mid-1930s. Bush's friend and fellow bonusman Knight Woolley, another partner at BBH, wrote to Avril Harriman in January 1933 warning of problems with CSSC after the Poles started their drive to nationalize the plant. The Consolidated Silesian Steel Company situation has become increasingly complicated, and I have accordingly brought in Sullivan and Cromwell, in order to be sure that our interests are protected," wrote Knight. After studying the situation, Foster Dulles is insisting that their man in Berlin get into the picture and obtain the information which the directors here should have. You will recall that Foster is a director and he is particularly anxious to be certain that there is no liability attaching to the American directors. How Bush's grandfather helped Hitler's rise to power, The Guardian, September 24, 2004. According to Loftus, head of the CIA, Alan Dulles saw to it that a Dutch connection remained unexplored. He successfully discredited journalists probing too far into the laundering of Nazi money. American investigators had to be sent anywhere but Holland. If the investigators realized that the U.S. intelligence chief in post-war Germany, Alan Dulles, was also the Rotterdam Bank's lawyer, they might have asked some very interesting questions. They did not know that Thiessen was Dulles' client as well. Nor did they ever realize that it was Alan Dulles's other client, Baron Kurt von Schroeder, who was the Nazi trustee for the Thiessen companies which now claimed to be owned by the Dutch. The Rotterdam Bank was at the heart of Dulles' cloaking scheme, and he guarded its secrets jealously. Attorney John Loftus, How the Bush Family Made Its Fortune from the Nazis, Tetrahedron Publishing Group, September 27, 2000. A 2003 article by Bob Fitrakis and Harvey Wasserman in the Free Press, Columbus, Ohio, claimed that George W. Bush, Karl Rove, whose alleged grandfather helped run the Nazi Party, and Arnold Schwarzenegger had destabilized California and were on the brink of bringing it a new Reich. Arnold Schwarzenegger's Austrian father joined the Nazi SA and became a ranking officer. To cover himself, Schwarzenegger has made substantial donations to the Los Angeles-based Wiesenthal Center, which tracks down ex-Nazis. Arnold has also renounced Hitler. But he has not renounced his friendship with fellow Austrian Kurt Waldheim, the one-time head of the United Nations with known Nazi ties. The book Arnold, An Unauthorized Biography, documents Arnold toasting Waldheim, who had participated in Nazi atrocities during World War II, at his wedding to Maria Shriver. "My friends don't want me to mention Kit's name, because of all the recent Nazi stuff and the UN controversy," Arnold said. "But I love him and Maria does too, and so thank you, Kurt." On May 17, 2001, Schwarzenegger also met with Kenneth Kenny Boyle of Enron at the Peninsula Hotel in Los Angeles. Lay has been George W. Bush's chief financial backer, and a close associate of Karl Rove's. According to Bob Woodward's Bush at War, Bush attended a New York Yankees game soon after the September 11 World Trade Center disaster. He wore a fireman's jacket. As he threw out the first pitch, the crowd roared. Thousands of fans stuck out their arms with thumbs up. Karl Rove, sitting in the box of Yankee owner George Steinbrenner, likened the roar of the crowd to a Nazi rally. Bob Fitrakis and Harvey Wasserman, Sieg Heil, The Bush-Rove Schwarzenegger Nazi Nexus and the Destabilization of California, The Free Press, Columbus, Ohio, October 6, 2003. Fahrenheit 9/11 is a 2004 documentary film by American filmmaker and political commentator Michael Moore. The film takes a critical look at the presidency of George W. Bush, the war on terror, and its coverage in the news media. It documents that the American people were lied to in the push for war, and examines the relationship the Bush and Bin Laden families had for over 20 years. It referred to Ray Bradbury's 1953 novel Fahrenheit 451. A tall story had circulated that in 1918, Prescott Bush and two companions from the Skull and Bones fraternity crept into the cemetery near Fort Sill and pried open the grave of Geronimo, the Apache Indian warlord. Geronimo's head was allegedly taken to Yale University and stored in its secret Skull and Bones Society. In 2006, Joseph Cannon posted an attention-grabbing article on the internet. It was about Aleister Crowley and Pauline Pierce, born Pauline Robinson, whose third child was named Barbara. Marvin Pierce, the president of the McCall Corporation, which published McCall's magazine and Red Book, married Pauline, a beautiful young socialite, in 1919. but Pauline scandalized her social circle by traveling to France on her own in 1924 and leaving two very young children in the care of nursemaids. Pauline had befriended a woman named Nellie O'Hara, an American adventuress who at some point during her European travels shacked up with the well-known writer Frank Harris. Aleister Crowley received much financial backing from author Harris and was said to have undergone the supreme ordeal connected with his achievement of the grade of Ipsissimus, the highest magical act within his order. If he did undergo a test of sex magic sacraments in 1924, we may presume that his routine associates of that time, including Nellie and Pauline, functioned as his assistants. Pauline returned to America in early October of 1924. On June 8, 1925, Pauline gave birth to a girl named Barbara. Barbara Pierce married George H.W. Bush, who later on became the 41st President of the United States. Was Aleister Crowley the true father of Barbara Bush? Joseph Cannon posted his disconcerting commentary on the 1st of April. Joseph Cannon, George W. Bush, Barbara Bush, and Aleister Crowley, Cannon Fire, April 1, 2006. Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, 1950, is the first volume of a trilogy written by the Greek-Armenian mystic G. Igurgyev. Beelzebub, a man of otherworldly wisdom, is an extraterrestrial that shares with his grandson the anecdotes, personal philosophies, and lessons learned from his own life. The plot of Beelzebub's Tales is a world-famous cosmological epic to his grandson Hassan, as they travel through space. It mainly recounts the adventures and travails of Beelzebub among the humans of the planet Earth. Beelzebub covers the entire history of the strange behaviors and customs of these beings. In the Bible, Beelzebub, or Beelzebul, from Baal-zebub, Flylord, is the Philistine god of Acheron, Ekron, typified as the chief devil. Beelzebub is a fallen angel in Milton's Paradise Lost. Margie Schottinger was a young black woman from Houston, Texas, who made a complaint in 2002 that she had been repeatedly drugged and raped by George W. Bush and his secret agents that wore face covers. They purportedly exposed her to indignity and trauma. But due to the far-fetched atmosphere of her allegations, the local authorities presumed that Margie Schottinger was psychologically disturbed. 2 years later, horrible Abu Ghraib prison photographs were seen around the world. Images of U.S. government agents wearing face covers while afflicting prisoners in Iraq looked much like Margie Schottinger's original descriptions. Evidently, she had counseled authorities wisely. But by then, Margie had passed away from a gunshot wound in an apparent suicide. Gina Haspel became the first woman director of the CIA but faced torture accusations. The autopsy pathologist examined some photos a supervisor had given him. A mediator watched on. They were demonstrations of waterboarding. Notice anything absent? The pathologist quickly asked and paused for a long moment. There are no boards in these photographs, he finally pointed out. They didn't let slip on how they crossed together two wooden boards, the surgeon remarked. One of the earliest reported victims died of asphyxiation and had water and blood flow out of his lung when his side was pierced with a spear. At length, the rundown Abu Ghraib prison would finally serve as an eerie reflection of the Bush-Cheney administration. Near the secluded entry of a corridor would flicker a single candle on a small tablet that would say, Memorial of Margie Schottinger. But she would not think of battle that reduces men to animals. So easy to begin and yet impossible to end. For she, the mother of our men, did counsel me so wisely then. I feared to walk alone again and asked if she would stay. Uriah Heep, Lady in Black, 1971. In George W. Bush's presidential memoir, Decision Points, 2010, he said his mother, Barbara Bush, miscarried and showed him the fetus she put in a jar to take to the hospital. He understood that this fetus in a jar could be his brother or sister. Bush alleged that the reason he put it in the book was to show how he and his mother developed a relationship. Book reviews called it very bizarre. Amity over a jar filled with a dead fetus resembles Aleister Crowley in a scene from W. Somerset Maugham's 1908 novel The Magician. One might imagine Beelzebub's grandson revealing a homunculus in such an avowal. Banking alliances with the Nazis continued after Pearl Harbor, to avert an open scandal. It is nowadays widely acknowledged that Third Reich financiers permeated the American banking industry throughout World War II. But the U.S. government was not prepared to interrupt their business, for fear it might spark a national revolt or mutiny within the armed forces. Moreover, as some corporate executives were never tired of reminding the government, their trial and imprisonment would have made it impossible for the corporate boards to help the American war effort. Therefore, the government was powerless to intervene. Charles Higham, Trading with the Enemy, An Exposé of the Nazi-American Money Plot 1933-1949, 1983. Alfred Krupp was a member of the Krupp family, which had been leading in German industry since the early 19th century. The family corporation, officially identified as Friedrich Krupp AG Hochkrupp, was a key supplier of weapons and materiel to the Nazi regime during World War II. In 1943, Krupp became sole proprietor of the company, after the Lex Krupp, Krupp Law, decreed by Adolf Hitler. Alfred Krupp was convicted after World War II of crimes against humanity for the way he operated his factories, served 3 years in prison, and was pardoned. Krupp's wartime employment of slave labor resulted in the Krupp trial of 1947-1948, after which he was ordered to sell his property and was sentenced to prison. James Boxall of the Financial Times reported that the German engineering company Siemens was used as cover for Nazi spying and propaganda operations before and during the Second World War. The claims were based on previously secret MI5 files released for the first time in August 2010. An MI5 note to military intelligence in Singapore in late 1939 states, "It has come to our notice from various sources that the Germans are using as cover for their espionage activities certain important industrial and commercial concerns. In particular, the names of Messrs. Siemens Schuckert, Messrs. Bayer, and Messrs. Schering & Co. have come to notice in this connection. Siemens used slave labor from concentration camps to build electric switches for the military. There were also allegations in 1939 about Siemens branches in South America being regarded as a vast organization for Nazi espionage and propaganda. The Siemens bribery scandal in Greece was a corruption and bribery disgrace that hit Greece over deals between Siemens and Greek government officials during the 2004 Summer Olympic Games in Athens on the issue of security systems and purchases by OTE, Hellenic Telecommunications Organization, in the 1990s. Greece's far-right Golden Dawn, Chrissy Avgy, faction, accused of identifying with the German Nazi Party, was recognized as a political party in 1993. The Greek debt crisis was part of a Eurozone act triggered by a global economic recession after October 2008. The CIA allegedly plotted against Greece's Prime Minister Kostas Karamanlis in 2009. Suddenly, hard-working Greeks in their late 30s and mid-40s have no money to turn on the heat, to buy gifts for their children and loved ones, to fill the tank with gas, to fill the fridge with food, to invite friends for dinner, to go out and enjoy a drink in fine company. Maria Paravance, A Greek Christmas Carol, Huffington Post, December 25, 2013.